WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Patty Duke was a child star. At the age of 12, she won over Broadway audiences as Helen Keller in The Miracle Worker. 3 years later, she played Helen Keller in the screen adaptation and became the youngest actor ever to win an Academy Award. She then got her own TV sitcom, The Patty Duke Show, and she became one of TV's most celebrated teens. Maybe because Patty Duke grew up in public view, many of us assumed we knew something about what her adolescence was like. But last year, she wrote an autobiography that was filled with surprises. For instance, when she was a child, her parents virtually turned her over to managers who took control not only of her career, but of her life. When they changed her name from Anna to Patty, they told her, "Anna Marie is dead. You're Patty now." Patty Duke's autobiography, Call Me Anna, has just been published in paperback. She's now serving her second term as the president of the Screen Actors Guild. Since the 1970s, she starred in many made-for-TV movies, including a remake of The Miracle Worker, in which she played Helen Keller's teacher, Anne Sullivan. Patty Duke, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, should I call you Patty Duke? I feel silly.
You can call me anything you want.
Okay. You know, in your book, you write about all this stuff that I certainly never knew about. I'm sure most of your fans never suspected. Mm-hmm. You know, bouts with manic depression, attempted suicide, stuff like that. Now that you've gone public with it, do you feel like more vulnerable, more exposed, or more like yourself because people know the real story of who you are?
Frankly, the net result that I didn't expect from the book is this sense of freedom or being freed, because there's nothing left.
Nothing
there's
to
certainly
hide.
No skeletons. Uh-huh. And the most extraordinary thing has been the exchange with other people who share the same illness as me, manic depression, and others who just want to reach out and say, "We didn't know. That was terrible. And boy, are we glad you didn't kill yourself, because it is a good life." And that has been a remarkable series of experiences for me over the last year.
I want to talk with you a little bit about some of the, you know, key things that have happened in your life. Your parents basically turned you over to these theater managers.
Yeah, I prefer to put it another way, yeah. and this is in no way meant to be judgmental about the way you phrase the question, but yeah. To give a clearer picture, mm-hmm. I prefer to talk about the fact that my mother was really coerced
to
give me up. Mm-hmm. My mother also suffered from a mental illness until quite recently, a clinical and chronic depression. She was very insecure, had no money, limited education, and here were these people who seemed to be saying, "We have the yellow brick road in our pocket. And if you really love this little girl, if you really love her, then you'll be unselfish and you'll give her to us, and we will give her all the things you cannot." Well, I can almost imagine myself falling for that. It appeals to guilt, motherly guilt, that we're never good enough for our children. It certainly appeals to someone who feels inadequate about how to deal with life. And so that's what she responded to. My dad, by this time, was out of the picture. They had separated, and my father was an alcoholic and spent most of the rest of his very short life alienated from the family. So I went to live with them, and it seemed okay to my mom at the time, though very painful.
Did you protest?
No. It's interesting to me that I did not, because I was almost literally attached to my mother at the hip. I was a very dependent child, crazy about my mother. And these discussions happened without my being around. So that when the information was delivered to me, my mother had already steeled herself mm-hmm. for this, looked angry to me. I mean, that was my child's perception. Oh, she's mad at me. I did something wrong. And we didn't have the kind of household where you ask, where you questioned your mother about what was going on. So I assumed, stupidly, that this was what she wanted. And I went because I was going to be a good little girl. It's funny, even today I can get a little thing in my throat about it, because it was the most painful separation of my life, Though I have her back in my life now, we have a full, rich mother-daughter relationship. That's something you can't ever make up for. And I admire my mother for the courage she's had to face that kind of pain.
What are some of the things that this couple did who took over your career to refashion you into the person they think they thought you should be?
Yeah, these folks, though they come out in a very negative light for the most part in my book, were not complete villains in my eyes. And even in retrospect, I see that they had a talent. What they did was, number one, start schooling me in manners, taught me to speak in an English accent, so that it, their theory being that it would counteract the New York ease. I was a very New York kid who talked like this. Well, you can play one or two parts like that, but not very many. So there was there were many disciplined, highly disciplined hours of that kind of exercise, plus working on how I looked. Ethel, the wife of the twosome, often would tell me that I was very plain. Part of that, I think, was her attempt, though ill-guided, to keep me humble, to maintain control. And though I got much more affirmation from John Ross, the male part of the couple, her approval somehow carried a lot more weight for me.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Patty Duke, who's written an autobiography about her life and her career. Well, they helped you get an incredible part, the Broadway.
Absolutely. They did a lot of wonderful things. I started working quite early and well and with wonderful people in live television. And then, yes, the Miracle Worker was a year and a half of preparation before I was ever granted an audition.
What kind of preparation?
The preparation began, of course, with learning about Helen Keller, but only up until Annie Sullivan arrives in her life. Again, the theory being, don't give me more information than I need and maintain control. Then, on a daily basis, I was put through exercises pretending to be blind, stumbled around the house with my eyes closed. Other exercises about being deaf. Games were played. You know, I was a kid, so they used the game approach, and I was not to hear anything, let's say, for an hour and a half. If sometime during that hour and a half the phone rang or Ethel said to me, there's a call for you, and I responded, I had blown the game. The difference in this kind of training is that not always were the methods kind. Mm-hmm. They weren't always evil, but there were often very denigrating remarks made rather than corrections. And again, it's something that I recall because it was important to me when I was raising kids to not do that to them, you know, to correct rather than, you know, call them wicked little whatever they are.
I remember the first time I saw The Miracle Worker, the movie, when I was a child. I liked the movie a lot, and it scared me a lot.
Really?
Yeah, it scared me because the whole idea that somebody could go through life both blind and deaf terrified me. And when you're a kid, you always figure, like, well, God, this could happen to me tomorrow, you know?
Sure.
So it was a very frightening thing, and I figured, gosh, it must have been frightening for you to, especially when you were playing it on Broadway, when you were younger. You have to think about that so much, about what it would be like to be blind and deaf.
Frankly, I can't believe this, but I've never really thought of it in those terms before. I had many, many, many fears and obsessive fears as a young person. And maybe I was incorporating them into that role. And I do know for a fact that the role was very therapeutic for me in many ways. The home life with the Rosses became quite distorted as I got to be 12 and 13 and 14, which were the Miracle Worker years. And to be able to go to a place every day and fight the authority figure full out, hit, bite, kick, and be applauded for it on top of that was incredible therapy, and what we now know is acting out therapy. Of course, I didn't know it then, but I do know that probably my illness would have shown itself much sooner if I didn't have those outlets. And, of course, the nurturing that I got from Anne Bancroft, not only on stage but off, she really, I think, is responsible for helping me through puberty. For, you know, if I never met Anne Bancroft, I probably still wouldn't know about birds and bees and all that kind of stuff. She was incredibly generous to me.
I just rented the movie recently to watch it again, and was really,
that,
you know,
tickles me.
Surprised at how good looking the movie is too. You know,
I was amazed.
Really nice,
yeah.
Shot and lit it is.
It's wonderfully directed, and though I, you know, had a major crush on Arthur Penn, I wasn't too much of a film critic in those years. But as I looked at it recently myself, and it is a well made film about, for me, the ultimate topic, which is the success of the human spirit. And when you couple that with wonderful art, wonderful photography, and well-directed actors, phew, it's a terrific film.
I think everyone who's seen the film remembers the scene of the breakthrough where Anne Bancroft as Helen Keller's teacher, Annie Sullivan, is working with you as Helen Keller, in trying to teach the association between objects and words. And there's the scene at the water pump where she's pumping water and she's spelling it out to you.
And she's angry, if you recall.
And she's angry,
she's,
right.
She's angry at me because I've just done something very naughty in front of the rest of the family.
But as the water's pouring on your hand, things pause for a second and you suddenly, it's your only lines in the movie, really.
That's right.
You start to sound out water. I'd like to play that excerpt of the film.
Oh, how interesting. I've never done this before.
Let's hear it.
W-A-T-E-R, water. It has a name. W-A-T.
Scene from The Miracle Worker in which Patty Duke as Helen Keller speaks for the first time. What kind of advice were you given about how to make those sounds, the first controlled sounds you utter?
I don't think I've ever told this out loud in public before. I think I wrote about it in the book. Arthur Penn wanted a particular sound, obviously the one we just heard. And I was a little girl with a little voice and it just kept coming out. And that wasn't it. And he gave me what I think is an absolutely brilliant direction and an impossible one for a little teenage girl who has a crush on the director to take. He came to me and he said, "Have you ever been constipated? I thought I would die." I mean, here he is. God is talking to me about constipation. I said, "Huh?" He said, "Well, you think about that. And then when it comes to that time, besides all the other things that you're feeling and doing, I want you to incorporate that." And of course, that's what you hear. And it is a wonderful symbol for Helen's intellectual constipation for those 6 years. There's a line that comes a little bit after this that belongs to Anne Sullivan. It's when the parents come out of the house and they're wondering what's going on and what is all this yelling about. And she says, "She knows. I tell you, to this day, when I watch that movie or hear that, or even hear those words, it has such impact on me. That tells me that knowledge and communication and understanding are probably the keys to what I'm all about."
Actress Patty Duke is my guest. You know, it's really amazing. You went from The Miracle Worker, doing it for years on stage and then on screen, to starring in this sitcom about this about two well-adjusted teenagers.
Not a logical progression, huh?
Really.
Again, believe it or not, the cleverness of the Rosses, and I mean this in a positive way.
The people who managed.
Yes,
yeah.
the mentors. They predicted that, remember, back then we didn't have quite as many shows for teens as we do now, and they predicted that there was going to be a transition problem. Many young actors didn't make it through the teens and into adult acting. So the plan was, as long as we've got this offer for this television series, we'll put her in that. That'll get her through those, quote, awkward years. Now, it made sense to them, but I must tell you, I was not there for the telephone call, but I'm aware that Arthur Penn, when he heard that this was the deal that had been made, called up and just wanted to whip them soundly for this hideous mistake. In some ways, I think, even today, that Arthur was right.
Uh-huh.
I will never be sorry about the Patty Duke show, because that has given me an access to the public that I don't know I could have gotten any other way. And an access on many levels. But I think that one of the many speculations about why I don't have a film career, you know, on the big screen, is that I moved into television quite early, and folks simply hold up this one piece of remarkable work and say, oh, when she was a child, she did this. And now I'm thought of as a whole other entity. I no longer feel bitter about that, because I've found ways to use it in a positive way for myself. But it is one of the explanations for why, when I say to myself, why is that one playing that role? Now, I could have played that. It's one of the many reasons.
My guest is actress Patty Duke, who's written an autobiography, which is titled Call Me Anna. We're going to talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Patty Duke is my guest, and she's currently serving in her second term as president of the Screen Actors Guild.
I have to tell you.
What, you're not?
You know what that sounds like to me? Oh, yes, I am. Oh. Yes, I am, unfortunately. It's beginning to sound to me like it's a prison sentence.
Oh.
I'm serving my second
She's serving term. Her sentence.
Exactly.
Do you mind if I ask you just a couple of things about the Patty Duke show?
You can ask me anything you want.
Who came up with this idea of identical cousins? For our listeners who don't remember the show, Patty Duke played this, like, really popular American teenager, and also played this American teenager's Scottish cousin who was much more prim, proper, and conservative.
My goodness.
I didn't know about rock and roll.
didn't seem to know much about anything that had to do with the, quote, real world.
Now, they were identical cousins. They
identical
looked exactly
cousins.
The same.
Do you not
Patty
love
Duke
that?
Played both of them.
I have no idea why. Sidney Sheldon is the man who created the show.
Mr. Bloodline?
Yes. Why cousins? I don't know. I think it had something to do with, you know, why wouldn't they have been in the household the same, you know, all these years behaving the same way. Also, I think they wanted some version of God knows what that accent was that I did. but I must say, most people, when they talk to me about it, you know, folks on the street talk about the twins. They forgot the cousin part.
Well, I think I went through my early years thinking, can there be identical cousins?
Oh my God.
Is this possible?
I love it. Oh, we were filled with misinformation on that show, but I must say, I just saw, again, I was never allowed to watch that show. So I saw it only recently, and I was kind of happily surprised. All these years, I'd been kind of embarrassed by the whole thought, and I really would kind of, you know, turn my head and eyes away when people would mention it. For its genre, it was quite a lovely little show, and they were nice people, and they weren't saying nasty, hideous things to each other all the time. And I kind of miss that element of a family show.
We know you mentioned that you weren't allowed to watch it. It's because the people who were managing you thought it would go to your head if you got
exactly,
to see yourself.
Exactly, yes. We dealt a lot in keeping me humble.
So what really
it worked
when you watched it for the first time as an adult? This was recently that you saw it for the
it
first
was
time.
2 years ago, my husband was still in the army. I was visiting from Los Angeles, and he was in Georgia. And I was waiting at the hotel for him to get off duty. And so I turned on the television, thinking I'd watch some talk show in the middle of the afternoon, and I heard the theme. Now, the theme I had heard before, because people sing it to me verbatim on the street corners often. So there it was. And it was strange to say. I mean, there I was all alone in this hotel room, and I was going to turn it off. And now I don't know if that was a knee-jerk reaction from the Rosses, or I was afraid I was going to be mortified or what. And I said, nope, this is it. I'm going to watch it. And I went and I put the Do Not Disturb on the door so the maid wouldn't catch me watching the Patty Duke show. And I sat there on the edge of the bed. And yes, I was at first embarrassed, particularly about how I looked. How could anybody let me go out of the house looking like that, with that flipped up hair and the turned under hair? And they were three-quarter wigs with this crevice.
You had headbands on all the time.
Oh, yes, that was to hide the crease. And the more I watched, the more I thought, oh, she really wasn't that ugly, that girl. And this is kind of a nice show. And then I noticed that I was also doing some very nice acting work.
Uh-huh.
It was, you know, based on very thin premise, but nonetheless, there was some very real work going on there. So I was glad I finally saw it, and I don't have to go cringing and skulking through hallways anymore when I hear the music.
You know, throughout our conversation, we've been referring to the two people who managed you and did
John and Ethel Ross.
Yeah, we're pretty tyrannical about it. How'd you get away from them?
Oh, the typical way, I guess, a young girl in those days got away from the family they didn't like. I got married.
Right.
I was ill-equipped to do that or anything else at that point, because once I made the move, the manic depressive symptoms came out. Once there were not the Ross's disciplines on the behavior, the demons, if you will, woke up, and I was quite out of control in the late 60s.
I think it wasn't until 1982 that you were actually diagnosed.
That's correct.
As manic depressive, and you started taking both chemical and
counseling. Talk therapy,
talk therapy. Yeah. What were some of the things that you thought were happening to you before you had the manic depressive diagnosis?
It was very difficult to even think about it, you know, to have conscious thoughts about it. When I would be in a manic phase, certainly I thought everything was fine. Now, it was rather bizarre behavior I was exhibiting, but it seemed okay to me because I was comfortable out there. Your mind races. Thoughts come so quickly that you can't get them out of your mouth fast enough. Manics talk very quickly. Spending huge sums of money that I didn't even have.
Mm-hmm.
Went into credit card hell. When I would come down from that, and there were many other symptoms of it as well, just a lot of acting out stuff and self-destructive stuff. But I felt a sense of euphoria. When I would come down from that and sort of head into the depressive time, there were pretty level times, really. And you didn't think about what you just did because that's just too much to deal with. You have to block that completely. And I also never learned to know that what was coming was the black hole. And I would go into that for 3 and 4 months at a time, be for a good deal of that time non-functional. I mean, literally staying in bed, crying or past the crying, or suicidal.
So this did not help other relationships or
it's,
work.
It's not what you should bring to a marriage.
No, exactly. So now all that's under control.
Yeah, it's very important for me that people understand how it gets under control, so that we don't, you know, think, oh, there's this wonderful miracle. You know, it is a very difficult diagnosis to make. Can be made though. People who are feeling similar symptoms need to go to a doctor, usually a psychiatrist. That's of course always the giant step. It's a giant step, well worth taking. I then, after my diagnosis was made, I was put on lithium, and I fortunately have no bad side effects from lithium. Some people do. Most people tolerate it quite well. That, within 3 weeks, leveled me. I was now in a therapeutic range and in control of the mood swings. That doesn't mean I don't, you know, get happy or get sad. It just means that I can deal with them when I do. And of course, I have to stress that continuing a healthy relationship with your psychiatrist is only wise. It's very wise to do. You know, many people stop taking their medicine because they miss the high. And I can only say,
yeah,
don't do that. Don't do that. I would no more stop taking my medicine than fly to the moon. It's a fascinating illness, but It's fascinating when it's history.
Patty Duke is my guest. You are now in your second term as president of the Screen Actors yes. Guild. Why did you want to do that, to go into organizing and to be in an administrative and a leadership position, which is very different?
I wish I could tell you that I had thought it out that completely. I had become very active in my union. And about time, I might say. Most of us sort of, you know, get our card and that's it. We don't pay attention. When it became apparent that union busting was becoming a way of life in mm-hmm. our country, I became, just as a citizen, more and more concerned. Yes, I wanted more of a leadership role. When some people suggested that I should run for the presidency of the Guild, it was at first a very heady kind of idea. But I also needed to know that I could back it up, that I could do the work. Once I decided that I could do that, I also wanted the label of respectability. When you've been manic depressive and you have done very strange things, it's very important to you to show mm-hmm. to people that you are responsible and respectable. And once you do that, then you can relax and be responsible and respectable. You don't have to keep showing everybody.
So you think you're in that stage now where you can just relax about it?
Well, I never relax about that job. You know, it's not exactly the kind of job people call up and say, oh, things are swell.
I wish we had more time to talk, but we're out of time. It's really been a pleasure to have you
here. This is a wonderful program, and I'm so glad it's so successful and it'll stay on.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. My guest has been actress Patty Duke, and she's now the president of the Screen Actors Guild. Her autobiography has just been published in paperback. It's titled Call Me Anna, and it's published by Bantam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.